Hello everybody, welcome to Hold the Line. My name's Joe and I'm a British force-free gundog trainer. You can check out my online courses at forcefreegundog.com. The newest course is called Training the T-Drill. You can also pick up a copy of my book called Force-Free Gundog Training, The Fundamentals for Success, which is available on Amazon's everywhere around the world. There's also an accompanying workbook to record your training sessions in. I'm currently working on a sequel to Force-Free Gundog Training, and I hope it's going to be out maybe in about 6 months. We'll see. That's all for now. Let's get on with the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Welcome back to Hold the Line. It's me. It's Joe. I've got a summer sale to tell you about to begin with. So my online course platform, forcefreegundog.com, sells all kinds of super duper gundog courses, and you can get a 40% off discount on your choice of course or courses in the plural if you would like for 1 week using the discount code SUMMER2023. That's SUMMER2023. Now, when I say 1 week, that is from the moment I upload the podcast, this episode. So there's always somebody who gets left out with these sales, and I always feel really bad because there's always somebody who contacts me or emails me just after whatever the deadline is and says, oh, I didn't realize I've missed the deadline, or sorry due to the time difference, blah, blah, blah. Or so guys, just don't leave it to last minute. Just go get your course, whatever it is that you want, from the site before the deadline expires so that I don't have to feel really bad and tell you that you can't have it and you have to wait for the next one. So it's summer 2023. And the website is forcefreegundog.com, and you'll get 40% off if you use that code. And if you have any problems, just email me, joe@forcefreegundog.com. All right, let's go on with the show.
Train your gundog without force or fear. Motivate and educate. Hold the line is here. Prevention, repetition, generalization, motivation. Hold the line.
So you might have noticed it's been a little while since the last podcast episode. One reason for that is we actually bought a house. I know it seemed like it was never going to happen. We did buy a house. We haven't moved yet though. So all of this has been like the stress and the pressure building up to, should we purchase this house? And are we going to get X to Y place in time? And it's just really complicated. But anyway, the purchase has gone through. We now own a house, which is a pretty cool thing to be able to say. And we're going to be moving in 2 weeks. So that's the middle of August. So it's going to be chaos. It kind of already is chaos. And my partner Adam is at the house sorting stuff out at the moment, because there are quite a few things that have to be done. Let me just tell you, this house was built, I think it was built in 1620, and there are quite a few things that have to be done. So hopefully these things are going to be done in 2 weeks, because whether they're done or not, we are moving in with all our stuff and our dogs. So they just better get done. No pressure, Adam. He doesn't listen to the podcast anyway, so I can say things about him like that. So, all right, let's get on. By the way, where is it? So the house is in the southwest of the UK. That's what I'll say. I'm not going to be offering, by the way, I should say this as well. I'm not going to be offering in-person classes when we move. I'm going to be focusing only on online material. So I'm going to be developing more online courses for my website. I'm going to be putting the finishing touches to the sequel for the Force Free Gundog book. And I'm just going to be doing all things online, really. Because you know what? The people that want to train their dogs using Force Free methods to do gundog work are scattered all over the world. They're not in any one geographical place. So it's not like I can position myself geographically somewhere where there's an abundance of people who want to do force-free gundog training. That's not going to happen. You're kind of scattered all over the place. So that's okay. To reach you, we will just take things even more online.
Hold the line.
All right, so what I was going to talk about in this episode are a few kind of bits and pieces. These are kind of things that have been rattling around in my mind, and they don't really fit in any one category. So I can't have an entire podcast episode about any one of these things. So I thought, why not just have sort of bits and pieces kind of episode where I just talk about these random things that don't fit anywhere else. So the first thing I wanted to say is, don't beat yourself up if you can't train your dogs. So there are going to be times in your life when you are busy, or maybe you're ill, or maybe you've got other stuff going on, or you've got other responsibilities, or I don't know, you've got life events happening, which mean that you can't put the time and the effort in that you would really like to be putting in with your dog. And you know that as well. Don't beat yourself up, because it's not helpful. It's not productive. It's not going to do anyone any good. So as easy as it is for me to say that, it's a lot harder to implement this advice, because I've been beating myself up a little bit because we've been so busy with all this house moving shenanigans, and occasionally the absence of house moving as well has taken some time. I've beaten myself up because there have been times when I haven't been going out with the dogs, especially, you know, with Roche, our Weimaraner. I want to give her a lot of one-to-one attention and really focus on her training needs, because she's a dog that has humongous potential. And at the moment, we are often, or I am often, going out with the three dogs together just purely to exercise them. And, you know, if I can just stop bad things being learned, then that's a job well done at the moment. If I can ensure that, you know, game doesn't get chased, dogs are steady, and that sort of thing, that's a job well done. Doing, advancing things and moving things forward and achieving new skills is not something that at this point I'm able to focus on. Although I have actually been surprised that things are improving even without the deliberate, conscious, focused effort. So that's quite interesting as well, isn't it? Maybe sometimes we don't need to try as hard as we do or focus on certain things as much as we do. Maybe there's a lot of learning that goes on without us realizing it in the dog's mind, particularly when we're talking about things like hunting. Because I kind of think of hunting as being, I don't know, it's slightly more of an art form, really, than the sort of pure science of running straight lines and handling drills and that kind of stuff. So I think also the environment is teaching the dog a lot of stuff when we're talking about hunting. And so exercising the dog, as long as you can do that in a way which is not going to allow the dog to learn the stuff you don't want them to learn, exercising the dog can actually be useful in some ways. I mean, I am exercising the dogs in places where there is game. We do have the opportunity to practice being steady. We have encountered a lot of rabbits. I would say we have made monumental strides in our steadiness to rabbits now, which is good. So, you know, maybe we haven't been doing as badly as I thought. So don't beat yourself up if you've got life events going on and you can't train your dogs. That's the first thing I wanted to say. Just take some time out. The next thing I wanted to say is that some dogs can develop very slowly. So this can be a sort of subgroup specific thing. So for example, with retrievers, you'll often hear of Labradors, for example, being made up to be a field trial champion around age 2. That's not uncommon. So a HPR, by the way, a Vestal dog, would probably still be a puppy and have a puppy brain at age 2. You would not really be expecting them to be made up to a field trial champion. I'm sure some have been, but they must be very much the exception. So the thing to say is that HPRs develop a lot more slowly than other breeds. Sometimes people say it's because they've got three jobs to do. You know, they have to hunt and they have to point and they have to retrieve rather than just do the retrieving side of things. I don't think that's what it is. There's something else that's going on. There's something about just generally maturing more slowly. It's not necessarily about learning. It's not about training. It's just about their brain and their mind and how mature it is at different ages. It's quite interesting, really. It must be some genetic explanation for this. But anyway, that's another thing I would say. So don't, you know, if you're used to, I don't know, training retrievers and you happen to get a HPR, don't expect the dog to develop at the same pace maybe as your previous dogs did. It may take, you know, a couple more years, actually. You'd probably be expecting your HPR to be really peaking maybe around the age of 5. So that's kind of, you know, they'll be at the top of their game. So think about that when you are, you know, judging your dog. And it just takes longer. And, you know, going along with that, don't be in a rush. Don't be in a rush, particularly with HPRs. This is a problem that I see people who are starting out often having. And it's like they just want to suddenly have a finished dog. They just suddenly want to have the dog being able to do everything all at once. And they kind of approach it like it's about a training thing. Like you just have to, you know, almost go down a list of tasks, like train your dog to do this, train your dog to do this, train your dog to do this. And it's almost like, you know, we just have to, you know, achieve these goals. But the thing is that the dog has their own kind of internal pace of development, and you can't kind of speed that up sometimes. You've got to go at their pace, their speed, their pace of development, and see what they're ready for. And, you know, are they ready to move to the next stage yet? Do you have that connection with them? And so on. So again, that's about maturity. But I think that if you haven't maybe owned or handled many dogs, you might not realize, you know, you don't have much to judge your dog against. And, you know, when is your dog mature? When is your dog ready for the next bit? What is a mature dog like, maybe, if it's your first dog? So you don't really know. You can't really judge when it's time to move on to the next step. So don't rush. Take your time. There is no rush. Alongside that, the next point is testing is not training. So this is something that I see quite often at various kind of clubs and organizations and, you know, gun dog training groups, really, around the country. And I'm sure this is the same wherever you live in the world. I'm sure this is the same for gun dog groups across the world, probably. So when I say testing is not training, what do I mean by that? Well, there are some training organizations, events that you can go to, and what they've set up is almost a test. Like, everybody has a turn at it. You go up one at a time to the instructor, and the instructor will tell you there's a dummy out there under that tree, and they'll explain to you what they want your dog to do, and then you try to get your dog to do it. And if your dog falters at any particular point, for example, then you will probably, you know, blow your whistle, or sometimes you'll walk out to the dog and reset them up somewhere. But you don't take the whole exercise apart into its component pieces and ensure the dog can do all those bits. So I'm trying to think of an example I can give you here to make this a little bit clearer, what I'm trying to say. So imagine that you have walked out to someone who's taking the class and they've said, there's a dummy under that tree, kind of 50 yards away, and there's another mark which is going to happen to the right. I would like your dog to ignore the mark and to go and get the blind under that tree, okay? So the mark happens, your dog is steady, you line your dog up for the blind, you send your dog, they start running for the blind, but then they're just tempted by the scene that they saw and they run over to go to retrieve that. You blow the stop whistle. Okay, so at this point, this is where everything's gone a bit, well, there's various different phrases we could use at this point. wrong, let's just say. So what do we do at this point? Well, really, if we were going to do things optimally, we would think, right, we need to practice this again, but we need to set it up in such a way that the unwanted behavior of the dog running for the mark doesn't happen. We need to ensure that the dog makes the correct choice. So how could we do that? Well, we could, from the very beginning, we can move right up really close to the blind so that the dog doesn't have to run very far to get the blind. And we could make sure the scene is much further away from us, so it's much less tempting. So that dog is going to be much more likely to be able to get that blind. And then we could do many reps, actually, and we could build back away from that starting position, back to the original starting position, incrementally, all the time, teaching the dog to keep on ignoring the mark to the right and to continue going to get the blind. So because we've done it in that very gradual way, we'll end up back at the starting point and the dog will be able to run the exercise. And we're not quite finished at that point because we need to kind of make sure the dog understands this concept. So we need to set up the same exercise but in a different location and make sure the dog understands the concept and not just how to do it right now in the specific place under these specific conditions. But it's a good start. So that's one possible solution we could have. Another solution is we could make the mark less tempting. So we could have the dummy thrower, for example, just go whoop, whoop, boringly instead of firing a shot, and maybe even place the mark on the floor in quite a boring way. That could be, you know, that can make it a lot more easy for many dogs. Particularly, you know, a lot of dogs get very excited by the sound of a shot. So if we take the shot out and we just go whoop, whoop, then that immediately makes it much easier for the dog to get the blind. We could even just take the mark out completely if the mark is making it really difficult. Just run the blind and make sure the dog does that maybe more than once. And then we could reintroduce a very boring mark and again, move it further away if we needed to. So there's lots of ways that we could approach this. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to go back before the mistake happened. We're trying to think about the concept behind the exercise, and we're trying to set it up to teach the dog to be able to encounter and manage those conditions in the way we want them to. What usually happens if you go to many training classes is at this point where everything goes a bit wrong, you will blow your soot whistle and then probably start handling the dog and giving, I don't know, a left back or something to get them to try to go to the blind instead. And often the dog will resist that because they still want to go get the scene, and you'll blow your soot whistle again, you'll give more handling, and there's lots of shouting and whistles. And, you know, maybe you do get the dog to end up finally getting the blind. But that's not really success, is it? Because in a test, you don't want to have to give 60,000 whistles and hand signals and stuff. You just want the dog to instantly, from your side, go to get the blind. So that's not really fixing things. So this is not, you know, teaching the dogs these concepts is not just about, does the dog get the right dummy at the end? It's about, what is the dog learning in the process of getting to that dummy at the end? And too often in these kind of group training classes, it's kind of fixed from the point where it goes wrong. And it's fixed with just doing what you'd have to do if you were in real life and there really was a bird down over there that you really had to get the dog to go and get, rather than treating it as a training situation, taking it apart, going back to the beginning and trying to prevent that mistake from happening. So that's how you should be approaching it. So really think about that and whether the training classes that you're going to are useful for your dog. There are ways that classes can be useful. For example, just being at a class with other dogs around and being in a situation with people and shots being fired, this can all be a very valuable experience for your dog. So even if you do have only access to a class where this kind of thing happens, it can still be useful, but you might want to make sure your dog has a good level of training before you go to that kind of class, because this is what is likely to happen. So if you do have a dog, you want your dog in this situation to just know already how to go and get a blind and not be tempted by the scene before you go to this kind of class. So that what you're at this class for is not to teach your dog that concept. You're at this class to hear shots and to have people around and to have other dogs about and to wait your turn and to practice all of that. So I hope that really makes sense. But the way that I summarize this is basically saying, you know, testing is not training, and training which resembles a test is not training either. So let's move on. Next point, which has kind of got something connected. Actually, all these points are kind of related. I'm now seeing, actually, I lied that these were completely separate points. Anyway, so the next point is, don't train to pass the lowest bar. What do I mean by that? So this is very, again, this is very common with people that are starting out. People starting out think, well, I don't know, I'm just starting out, I've got my puppy, and so the first thing I'm going to want to do is, for example, maybe puppy working tests. What is required at a puppy working test? Right, I'm going to invest all I've got into achieving those requirements, and I'm not going to think about anything else that my dogs might need to do in the future because we're not there yet. So let's just train for puppy working tests. So the thing to say about that is, God, in all ways, and I would go so far as to say that probably in all dog sports, I mean, people listening to this podcast will probably be doing other dog sports as well, so tell me if I'm wrong here, but I think this is probably across the board a true thing to say, that the kind of advanced handlers will have in their mind an idea of ultimately where they want to get to and ultimately what their goals are with a dog. And that's really what they'll be training towards. They won't be training to like the first rung on the ladder. They'll be training for where they think this dog can actually end up ultimately. And sometimes that means that they might have a dog that is a bit rubbish at the first rung on the ladder. And that's just because their focus isn't there. Their focus is much further ahead. So I'll try and give you an example of that. So for example, so if you are starting out with puppy working tests, for example, you might end up, let's say you've got HPR, you might end up doing lots of heel work, sit stays, because there's usually a little obedience test in most puppy working tests. So yeah, there's an exercise I really hate, which is one where people heel the dog to a certain point, leave the dog in a sit stay and walk away, sometimes throw a dummy, sometimes don't throw a dummy, and then recall the dog out of a sit stay. I just hate recalling dogs out of sit stays. And, you know, particularly at puppy level, I think that's like dogs often anticipate the recall and it just makes it really tricky. And the way that people end up practicing it is, again, this is back to my previous point, people end up practicing the thing that they ultimately want. Maybe this is the same point. I'm a bit confused now about the points. But anyway, people end up practicing the thing that they ultimately want, which is the sit stay and the recall out of the sit stay, when really you probably only need to do that in competition. In training, you should always go back and reinforce the dog in position and release them from right next to them. So you don't ever have that anticipation. Maybe once you might want to just check that your dog will recoil out of a sit state, just, you know, in case your dog has some kind of brain block about being able to do it. But once you've seen that your dog is able to do that, you don't need to practice that over and over again. What you do need to do is go back to the dog and reinforce the dog in position. You don't want the dog to anticipate a recoil before you've recoiled. So really, you would only need to do that when you're under assessment. You wouldn't need to do that ever in training, apart from that one time to check that it works. So that's one example. But the other thing to say, yeah, so let's go back to our puppy HBR, who was, you know, we were training them to do lots of heel work and sit stays and stuff. Now, ultimately, and a more advanced handler might think, well, my goal with this dog is to do field trials. Field trials don't involve heel work or sit stays. So I'm not really so bothered about that. I'm not fussed about being able to do heel work or sit stays with the dog. I'm actually not even going to bother training it at all because, you know, I want this dog to be a field trial dog and I think the dog's got potential to do that. And I don't really want to spend my training time heeling the dog around because that plays zero role in HBR field trials. So, you know, I think try and look ahead, try and think about what your ultimate goals are and maybe learn about what lies ahead instead of just thinking about the next step. People often assume that these steps are cumulative and that you need to do, for example, whatever the puppy needs to be able to do at puppy working test before you can move to the next level. And they need to achieve that level before you can move to the next level. It just doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that at all. Some of these skills are so different. They do not build on skills at the previous level at all. So learn about that and think about that. And don't assume that it's kind of, yeah, everything builds on everything else, because that's not how things work. Okay, next point. Next point actually is a bit different. You need game. You need game, you need land, and you need opportunities or experiences for your dog if you want to be successful. If you just want to use gun dog work to have a well-trained, quote-unquote, pet dog, then obviously you don't need these things. But if you want to compete with your dog, if you want to have a dog which is able to work as a working gun dog, then you do need to have access to this stuff. And people often don't realize this, and they often don't realize the importance of this, and they think that they can somehow be successful without this. And I would just say you can't, and you need to kind of think really hard about how you can provide your dog with these things, because they are essential. And that goes for whatever breed of dog you have, whether you've got a spaniel, whether you've got a retriever, whether you've got a HBR, whether you've got a pointer or a setter, it really doesn't matter. You need access to certain things to be able to train your dogs successfully. And often one of the things that the people who are successful have, or one of the things which differentiates people who are successful from the people who are not so successful, is just access to all this stuff. So let's think about, so game, it sounds a bit obvious, but you need access to game to be able to train your dog, whether that is wild game or whether that is game that you plant. It's something that you have to be able to have access to train your dog. And I would say you need to be able to roughly predict where it's going to be. So if you know, if you really can't predict it, then you don't know where to go to do the training. So, you know, every time you get up and you want to go and do a training session with your dog, you're thinking about, I want to work on this thing. I want to take my dog to this place to achieve this training objective. Then you need to have in your mind an idea of where you can go to access the game that you need to be able to train the stuff you need to train. So that's game. Land, you need to have access to land. And this is becoming a kind of a scarcer and scarcer resource, really, land. And, you know, you can do a certain amount of stuff on if you have access to public land, if it's rural public land. So in the UK, we have open access areas in England. So if you have access to open access land, that you can achieve a lot there. You can't obviously shoot over your dog there, but you can practice a lot of the aspects of gun dog work using open access land. But really, you're going to also need to be able to, if you really want to advance your dog to the point where you can shoot over them or they can be a working gun dog, then you need to have access to land that you can shoot on as well, or opportunities for your dog to be shot over. So that's also something that you need to work out too. And I would say on that note that one of the reasons why it's good to have your own land or have access to land which you can use in the way that you want to use it is that if you just go to kind of group training sessions, which are run by someone else, then you're kind of putting yourself and your dog in their hands, really. And that might work really well if they're experienced people, or if they're people who are able to judge what your dog needs well, then, you know, that could work really well. But sometimes you can just feel a little bit over controlled by the people who are running the session, and you end up letting them make choices for your dog, which are not necessarily what you think are the best choices for your dog in terms of their learning. So it's better if you can have more control, that's what I'm trying to say, over the situation. And to have that control, you're going to find it a lot easier if you own the land, really, or if you're setting up the training session, or if, you know, that kind of thing. So that's another little thing to talk about. And opportunities and experiences, well, that's kind of a similar thing, really. So that's kind of an opportunity to put your dog in the situation that is the working situation, whatever that is, equals for your particular dog. So all of these things are things that you need to have access to. And instead of kind of getting up every day and taking your dog to the local park and thinking that someday they're just going to transform from, you know, a dog that goes to the local park and is under reasonable control into your working gun dog, that's just not going to happen. So you have to gradually think about how to progress their training and how to gain these opportunities. And there can be an element of networking involved and, you know, working out who knows who and trying to, you know, there's a lot of that going on as well. So, but somehow or other, these are the things that your dog needs to have access to. So those are the things that I was kind of going to waffle on about. And they're not really, none of them are things about, you know, how to actually train your dog to do something. They're kind of behind the scenes thoughts about things. And I hope they're kind of useful. Well, let's get on to a kind of more training related question now.
Hold the line.
So someone contacted me this week with a question about water deliveries. And I think this is something we've covered before on the podcast, but it was some time ago. And it's also summer at the moment, so it's a good time to talk about this. So let's talk a little bit about water deliveries. So when any gun dog retrieves game out of water, whatever subgroup of gun dog they are, we want that game to be brought directly to the handler. Because if the game is not completely dead, if it's sort of, you know, still alive, but it's injured, and the dog puts it down because they want to shake, then that game can escape. And anyway, we always just want to see the game brought straight back to the handler. We never want to see the dog putting it down on the ground, whatever the reason is. So one reason that dogs want to shake is because their coat is full of water. It's very uncomfortable, I think, maybe for the dog. I mean, I'm not a dog, but that's kind of what I've always thought. Maybe the dog just feels a little bit uncomfortable and weird with their coat full of water and wants to shake it out. So that's usually the reason that they will put the game down, shake, and then pick it up and bring it to you. So what we have to teach the dog is to resist the temptation to shake. The other thing that can happen sometimes is the dog will shake whilst holding the game, which is also a little problematic because it can mean that the game gets damaged in their mouth, or the game gets damaged, whether it's because they're gripping extra hard to hold onto it while they shake, or whether it's because the motion of the shaking itself against their teeth damages the game. For one reason or another, that's often an outcome. So we don't really want them to shake at all, whether they're holding it or whether they put down to shake. So how do we address this? So the traditional way to approach this, let's just talk about that first, is for the handler to stand at the very edge of the shore, so there isn't any land for the dog to put the game down on, and very, very, very incrementally and gradually to progress away from the shore. So sometimes this works, but it's a little difficult to communicate to the dog what we don't want them to do once they've started to do it. It's very difficult, and some dogs just don't make the connection. They just don't. Also, if the dog does, for example, do a beautiful retrieve, so they go into the water, they're steady, they go into the water on cue, they get the retrieve, they swim beautifully back to you, or back to land at least, and then they put it down, shake, but pick it up and then bring it to you. So what do you do with that? Because the dog's done lots of things in that chain that we like. They've done, you know, they were steady, they swam out confidently and back again confidently, and maybe you've been working on their swimming and maybe that was a big deal for the dog, and they delivered it to hand eventually. So what do you do when the dog does that? Because they've done lots of stuff you like, and if you don't give them a treat or reinforce that retrieve, then you're not reinforcing any of it, really. So how do we approach this? Okay, so the way to approach this is the clicker retrieve. And there's a particular stage of the clicker retrieve, phase of the clicker retrieve, which I call proofing the hold against food, which really is a reverse lure. It's called a reverse lure, or a Zen hand. You might know this by lots of different names what I'm trying to describe. So basically what we do is we teach the dog to keep holding the retrieve in the presence of a food distraction, which is held down at nose height, nose or mouth height, in front of the dog, about 1 foot away from the dog. And we can even lure the dog around, so the dog will follow, as like a lure, they will follow this treat 1 foot in front of their nose whilst continuing to hold the retrieve until we click. So one of the concepts, one of the key concepts of the click and retrieve as I teach it, is this idea of hold until the click, drop at the click. So if you've got a dog which understands, really understands both those parts of the equation, hold until the click. So do not let go of the thing in your mouth until you hear the click, and drop at the click. So when you do hear the click, let go of the thing in your mouth. Then you have perfect control over the retrieve because you can communicate to the dog when you want them to continue to hold and when you want them to let go. And this is what you use when the dog comes out of water. So I usually suggest that when people teach this, they have a very sort of distinctive way to holding their hands. The dog recognizes this as well. I usually suggest people put a treat on the flat palm of their hand so that it looks very different to like a real lure, which is held between your fingers and your thumb probably and put right on the dog's nose. So that for the reverse lure, it's kind of a treat on the palm of your hand held out 1 or 2 feet in front of the dog at nose height. And that's kind of, you know, something that the dog learns, that picture of that treat on the flat of your hand. So once you can do this on land, and you do need to make sure that you're pretty fluent at it, you know, on land, first of all, before you try to use it around water, then you would have this at the ready as the dog comes out of the water. So as the dog comes out of the water, you would stand at the water's edge, just like the traditional trainer would, but you would put your reverse lure out instantly. So the dog comes out of the water holding the retrieve. You put your reverse lure out. You show the dog this reverse lure. And you have very low criteria at first. So as soon as the dog has held that retrieve for a split second in the presence of the reverse lure while coming out of water, you would click. The dog is allowed to drop at the click. So the dog will let go and drop the dummy on the floor at the click. And that's perfectly fine. That's part of the click and retrieve. And you would give the dog the reinforcer, the treat. So over time, you can ask the dog to hold the retrieve for longer before you click. You can also be more distracting and you can lure the dog around with the treat, but you'll end up with a dog which comes out of the water, sees your reverse lure, keeps holding the dummy, can be lured left and right and left and right, following this treat down at their nose height until you click, and then they let go and then they shake. So that's how we approach the water delivery issue and the kind of dropping to shake issue. And progressively then you would build back away from the water's edge so that you get to the point where, you know, you can stand really far away from the water and the dog still understands that they're not supposed to drop. Because by then holding on has become so habitual, the dog just doesn't think about dropping, and they kind of have the reverse lure in their mind because they've done it so many times coming out of water that they just tend to come straight back to you because that's what you've practiced so many times and that's what you've built up to. So I really hope that helps you with water retrieves, because there's probably lots of people doing water retrieves at the moment. Although having said that, it's actually chucking down with rain outside as I record this. So maybe everybody is tucked up inside in front of the fire, but it is summer. So probably people are doing water retrieves somewhere. So hopefully this is helpful for those of you, particularly those of you doing working tests, for example, or people who want to work on those water deliveries. The other thing, by the way, to say quickly about that, about the working on the delivery, is don't combine a really difficult, long, tiring retrieve with those reverse lures and deliveries, because, you know, it takes a lot out of a dog to go and do a good, decent, long distance water retrieve. And for them to do all of that and then come out of the water and possibly not get the reverse lure right and drop it, then they just wouldn't get a reinforcer for that beautiful, confident retrieve that they just did. Because if the dog drops, you have to stop the rep. So that's a little thing that I forgot to say. So if you're working on land, away from water, like in your kitchen or something, and you're doing a reverse lure and your dog drops, then you would snatch away the reverse lure. It disappears as soon as the retrieve comes out of the dog's mouth. If you haven't clicked yet, you'd snatch it away. You'd wait for the dog to pick it up again, and then you'd put your reverse lure out and you'd restart another rep. Now, when you're doing this around water, you can't do that because you end up teaching the dog that they can come out, let go of the dummy, probably shake, pick it up again, do another reverse lure, you know, and they get basically multiple reps. You have to teach the dog that they only get one chance to do this when they come out of the water. So if the dog gets it quote unquote wrong and drops before the click and they've just come out of the water, you can't let them pick it up again and have another go, because you're teaching them to drop then before they pick it up and have another go. So instead, you have to pick up that dummy and you have to do another retrieve with it out of the water so that you can get the end on that retrieve that you would like to see. So back to my original point, don't combine swimming a long distance with the reverse lure when the dog comes out. So keep these really short water retrieves when you're working on the reverse lure. All you want is a dog to get wet. You just want them to get their coat full of water so that they have that urge to shake as they come out. So they don't need to swim more than a few meters, just enough to get wet and a few paddles off their feet kind of thing. All right, so that's all for this week, everybody. And I will see you all next time. Now, it might be a little while before the next episode because I have to move house. So, you know, if you don't hear from me, that's probably what I'm doing. I hope that's what I'm doing. So anyway, wish us luck with that. And don't forget, the code is summer2023 for the discount at my website, forcefreegundog.com, on any course of your choice. And that is valid for a week from when this is uploaded. So see you all next time, everyone, on the other side, as it were. Hold on the line.